Hello and welcome to The Last Best Hope, a podcast from the RAI, Oxford's Centre for the Study of the United States and its Place in the World, in which we try to understand America from the outside in. I'm Adam Smith. In 1960, the United States was in many ways at the height of its post-war global power. Its immense economic strength as yet unchallenged by Japan or West Germany, racial tensions not yet having exploded into global prominence. This was the era of the liberal consensus, a concept much critiqued by historians, but still capturing an important truth about the pressure in those years to coalesce around a feel-good story about American democratic freedoms delivering a prosperous, expanding middle class at home, and peace and security against communist oppression abroad. That September 1960, the US was in the midst of a presidential contest between two young candidates, Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy, more different in temperament than they were in policy terms. Both were Cold War warriors. And then, wading in to shake up the party, came America's great Cold War nemesis, Fidel Castro, the leader of the new Cuban Revolution. Wearing combat fatigues and flying on a Soviet jet, Castro travelled to the belly of the beast, to New York City, to attend the General Assembly of the United Nations. It was a pivotal moment in the Cold War, with a host of newly independent former British and French colonies taking their seats in the UN for the first time, and a rising non-aligned movement led by Prime Minister Nehru of India and Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana and others. The balance of power in a polarised world was at stake. Here's Castro talking to the American press on arrival.
We will vote always with justice. We will vote always against colonialism. We will vote always against discrimination, racial. We will vote against imperialism, exploitation of the people. We will be always with justice. That is our plan.
What happened next is an amazing story, and one that's been told in detail by Simon Hall, Professor of History at the University of Leeds. And Simon Hall joins me now. Simon, it's great to see you. Thank you very much for joining me on the podcast.
No, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
So, Simon, let's just set this up a little bit. Give us the scene. September 1960, Fidel Castro, the leader of this Cuban Revolution, which has shaken the world, attracted the world's attention, famously just 90 miles off the coast of Florida, the United States gearing up for a presidential election, and Castro decides to go to New York. Why does he do that, first of all? And second, just kind of give us the picture when he arrives in New York. What's the reaction?
Yeah, so I mean, I think he goes to New York primarily because he sees it as a kind of extraordinary opportunity to kind of make his mark on the world stage because of the 15th General Assembly is happening. And basically almost anybody who's anybody is going to this meeting. It's a great diplomatic set piece of the post-war period. So you have, you know, Eisenhower is going, Macmillan is going, Khrushchev, Nasser, Nehru, and Nkrumah. Really, everybody who's a kind of a big deal in the kind of on the global stage is going to be there. And so Castro sees it as an opportunity to kind of mix it with the big boys, I suppose, and to make his own claims about his own importance as a leader, and also to publicize, draw attention to the Cuban Revolution, it's both its achievements, but also its place within a broader anti-imperial movement. So he's going there to sort of burnish his own sort of credentials, I suppose. But also he sees it as a great opportunity to make mischief and to cause trouble for the American government, which he succeeds in doing. When he touches down at Idlewild Airport, which is modern day JFK. There are several thousand supporters, mainly Cuban Americans, who've gathered there to kind of cheer him. And despite the fact that the weather is really sort of foul and it's pouring with rain, and as his motorcade heads into Manhattan, there are supporters on the lining the freeway to sort of cheer. And when he arrives at the Shelburne Hotel in Midtown, there's a big crowd there as well. So he's greeted quite raucously, but it's by a very select group of people. It's a big contrast. He visited New York in the spring of 1959 as part of a wider tour of the United States and Canada. And there he'd drawn huge crowds of all different types of Americans. This one, a year or so later, his popularity has dwindled among many white Americans, but he's still very popular among African Americans, Cuban Americans, and other sort of people in New York of Latin American origin or descent.
This is before the Kennedy administration, and we you know, people have heard of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and people may have heard of the Bay of Pigs invasion. This is before all of that, of course. So take us back to this moment. What did the Cuban Revolution seem to represent? Why were some people, albeit people of Latin American extraction in the main and African Americans, why were some people excited by Castro, and why had the majority of white Americans turned against the Cuban Revolution if they'd ever been sympathetic to it in the first place?
Yeah, so when the revolution first takes place, when Castro seizes power, it does capture the imagination of a lot of people in the United States and elsewhere, partly because of the sort of the aesthetic of it or the style of it. It sort of seems as though sort of a group of kind of, you know, very young, quite kind of bohemian looking rebels have just kind of swept down from the mountains and kicked out a terrible dictator. And it's also at that point, very early on, it's seen as not a communist revolution. It's seen as a kind of liberal revolution, a nationalist revolution, something that can command quite a lot of support politically in the United States. And when Castro goes to the United States in April 1959, you know, thousands of people turn up at Harvard University where he gives a talk. And Arthur Schlesinger, the historian who's later an advisor to Kennedy, sort of writes about this as though the undergraduates sort of see him as a sort of a hipster figure who's just sort of, you know, thrown out a government of wicked old men. So there's a kind of a big generational aspect to his appeal.
I mean, there's a lot of truth to that, isn't there? I mean, we look at him now and he looks like a kind of hipster figure with his beard. And how old was he in 1960?
I think he's about 34, I think. So yeah, he was young. Certainly a lot younger than Eisenhower, who's approaching 70. And a decade or so younger than John F. Kennedy, who's running for the presidency. And his appeal among African Americans in particular is centered on the fact that within weeks of taking power, his government passes a series of laws that outlaw segregation in private clubs, hotels, on beaches, swimming pools, and so on, and commits the revolutionary government to ending racial discrimination. So this is a big deal. As you said, Cuba is just 90 miles off the coast of the segregated South, and his willingness to overturn the kind of racial order in Cuba seemingly overnight is seen as a real breath of fresh air. So that explains why he retains his appeal among African Americans. He's less popular with other groups for a number of reasons. One is there's a big sort of PR disaster really by the Cuban government, because they have a series of sort of show trials for senior Batista regime figures who are then convicted and shot. And this goes down quite badly in the United States. You sort of see it as a retributive justice and talk about a kind of Cuban bloodbath. The government also becomes increasingly, at least in the view of the Americans, authoritarian. So it kind of bears down on the free press. It restricts academic freedom. It restricts the freedom of the judiciary. So it seems to be taking a sort of authoritarian turn. And most important for the Americans, it starts to nationalize or otherwise interfere with American-owned businesses. Those policies go down very badly in Washington, and the disagreements become increasingly bad-tempered, ill-tempered. And so there is a sort of a war of words between Cuba and the United States, which means that by the spring, summer, early autumn of 1960, relations between the two are pretty poor.
You noted that at this point in September 1960, it still wasn't clear that Castro had chosen sides in the Cold War. It still wasn't clear that he was establishing a communist regime in Cuba. So can you talk a little bit about how Castro saw himself as part of this kind of mix of world leaders? I mean, I note that, you know, you talk in your book about how he met up with Nehru, for example, the Indian leader. How was he trying to position himself in global political terms?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's a bit tricky to know for sure, because sort of two things are going on really in New York with Fidel. So one of the things he's doing is meeting with these big characters, with Nehru, with Massa, with Nkrumah, and is seems to be positioning Cuba alongside those leaders and those countries, and making Cuba and Latin America part of this broader non-aligned movement, a movement which is defining itself in terms of anti-colonial nationalism and against quote-unquote Western imperialism. So he's doing that, and he wants to be seen. He wants to be photographed with these leaders. He wants to meet with them. He wants to build bridges and alliances and find common ground with them. And a year or so after this, Cuba does join, becomes a member of what's formed as the Non-Aligned Movement, an official group of these nations. But at the same time, he's doing that. He's also hobnobbing with Khrushchev and becoming increasingly. You know, they seem to get on really well, Fidel and Khrushchev, and this is coming at a moment when Cuba is becoming much closer to the Soviet Union. It's turning to the Soviet Union for economic help as America is becoming more hostile. So those two things are going on. There's a bit of a sense that Fidel is wanting to do both. He's wanting a strong economic and military alliance potentially with the Soviet Union, looking to the future for that. But also he wants Cuba to be identified with the kind of global South, with the anti-imperial movement, with a non-aligned bloc. So he's trying to do both in a way.
Strikes me, and this is a lot from reading your book, I mean, Khrushchev and Castro are kind of, you could sort of see why they would either get on really well or they would really hate each other, because they're both larger than life characters. They're both extremely eccentric. They're both showmen. The interesting thing about Khrushchev, and I guess about the Soviet Union more generally at this time, but it seems to bear particularly on Khrushchev, is that in relation to the non-aligned, the non-aligned movement, as you say, define themselves around anti-colonial struggles, and so it's these newly independent post-colonial nations who are at the heart of it, at the leaders of this movement. And there's something about the Soviet Union at this point would kind of like a little bit of that themselves, wouldn't they? I mean, if there's anti-imperialism going around, well, they see themselves as an anti-imperial power too, don't they?
Yeah, totally. And I mean, so from that point of view, there isn't necessarily a contradiction, because unlike Stalin, who viewed non-communist movements for national liberation as class enemies, he views these anti-colonial nationalist movements as potential ally supporters. He's willing to spend huge amounts of Soviet resources on development projects across Africa and Asia to try to, you know, win alliances, win support, build up influence. Khrushchev sees himself as, and his, he views the Soviet Union and the Soviet project as anti-imperialist. Yeah, for sure.
I want to move on to talk about Castro in New York. He goes to a Midtown Manhattan hotel, first of all, and basically gets fed up there, doesn't think they're being treated as well as they should be by the management and the staff. There's this moment when he strops off to Dag Hammarskjöld in the United Nations headquarters and demands that the Cuban delegation be allowed to sleep on sofas inside the UN building. And when that doesn't seem to come off, he moves up to Harlem. And your book is called 10 Days in Harlem. So tell us about that move, which is the kind of signature move. It's the reason really why the Castro visit to New York in September 1960 is most remembered. He moves up to Harlem, and in doing so, he puts himself at the heart of the historic African-American community in New York City.
Yeah, I mean, it's an extraordinary moment. And, you know, it's not just that he goes to Harlem, but he goes to the Hotel Teresa, which is this huge landmark building right in the heart of Harlem. It's just around the corner from Louis Michaud's famous African nationalist bookstore. it's right around the corner from where all the street orators gather. So he's right in the very heart of Harlem, the very center of the kind of African-American political world, I suppose. And then his very first guest is Malcolm X. Just, you know, he's barely had time to check in when Malcolm X turns up, and they get on really well. They have there's some wonderful photos of them chatting in Fidel's hotel suite, both sort of perched on the edge of the bed because there isn't any real furniture to accommodate them. And, you know, this just sends out a message, really, that puts Fidel and Cuba very firmly on the side of African-Americans, on the side of the African-American freedom struggle, and on the side of the sort of quote-unquote oppressed people of Harlem. And then because he spends most of his time in Harlem, you have this extraordinary thing where you have all these leaders who make their own pilgrimage up to the Teresa to meet with him there. And this is also kind of extraordinary because it's an area which is usually kept hidden from the outside world. When Khrushchev was in the United States in 1959, he did a big, hugely successful tour of the United States in 1959 as part of a moment in the Cold War where it looked as though superpower tensions were easing a bit. He spent time in New York, and he was insistent that he wanted to go to Harlem. And eventually his American minders allow him to go to Harlem, but they drive him through Harlem in the early hours of the morning on the way to the airport as he's flying back home, when there's nobody around. So it's an area where the American government is very keen that people don't see it. And they don't want people to see it because it's an international embarrassment in terms of its racial situation. So it's endemic poverty, it's crumbling buildings, there's slumlords, there's problems with crime, problems with disease like asthma and tuberculosis. There's sort of endemic police corruption and police brutality. And so by going to Harlem, Fidel doesn't just draw attention to the kind of vibrancy of the African-American freedom struggle in 1960, but he also draws attention to all of the problems that African-Americans who live in Harlem are faced with every day. You know, segregation, both formal and informal, poorly funded, inadequate schools, police brutality, all of this kind of stuff. And this runs totally against the kind of story that the American government is telling to itself, to its citizens, and to the world about race relations. What the State Department is saying is, you know, yes, there is a race problem. It's confined mostly to the South for historic reasons because of the legacy of slavery. But look, it's in the process of being gradually worked through in a peaceful, democratic manner in keeping with our constitutional form of government through Supreme Court rulings, carefully worked out federal initiatives and new legislation. And Fidel's visit to Harlem draws the world's attention to the problem of racism and segregation in the North, in America's most important, most famous city, and in a city which kind of encapsulates post-war American liberalism. I mean, its mayor, Robert Wagner, is an archetypal post-war liberal. He supports trade unions, he supports liberal reform efforts, he supports welfare spending. He's a liberal Democrat. And yet this really important section of his own city is blighted by all kinds of racial discrimination. So the idea that it's just a sort of a localized problem which is being worked through and solved peacefully and democratically is exposed as something of a fiction. So and of course this goes down really well in Harlem. They think this is a great hoot that Fidel has turned up and everyone's looking, and the State Department officials are kind of tearing their hair out at what they do about it. And it matters because 1960 is a year when, I know, more than a dozen newly independent African nations are joining the United Nations. Many of their diplomats and senior government officials are in New York exactly at this time. And their allegiances, their loyalties, their sympathies are up for grabs in the kind of Cold War contest. So it's a diplomatic, well, we would call it today a challenge, wouldn't we? It's a challenge for the State Department. It's a challenge for the Eisenhower administration. Yeah.
It seems from your book as if Eisenhower doesn't really rise to that challenge very well, isn't there? There's a moment where the State Department's saying, look, Mr. President, you've got to go and have dinner and have lunch with these newly independent, the leaders of these newly independent African countries. And he's kind of, no, I'll see them all together. I can't be bothered to go and see them all individually. So is there a sense in which Eisenhower, I mean, he's on his way out, I guess. He's at the very end of his second term, but he just doesn't quite rise to the challenge here, does he?
No, he definitely doesn't. And you get the sense that there are people in the State Department who really understand that this is a key moment, that these new independent countries are there and first impressions matter. And it's really worth spending time and effort and turning on the charm to try to make sure that those relations get off to a good start. And Eisenhower just doesn't, he doesn't get it. He doesn't rise to the challenge. He's emotionally unable really to relate to it. I think he's suspicious of a lot of these new leaders. He totally doesn't get neutralism. He doesn't get the non-aligned business. He thinks it's, you know, he says things like, you know, he understands why you might want to be neutral between two power blocks, but when it is a question of being free or not free, or a question of being right or wrong, how can you be neutral on those questions? So he sees it through a very sort of particular lens, a Cold War anti-communist lens. And actually, you know, when he does meet African leaders one-on-one, it often goes very badly. So in a way, it's maybe better that he doesn't spend much time. He meets the one leader that he really likes and that he spends time with is the leader of newly independent, the Togolese Republic, a guy called, I think it's Sylvanus Olympio. And he really likes this guy. And he writes about how, you know, it's very telling. He says, oh, he has a sense of humor, which you don't often find in many of these African leaders. Which you think, yeah, okay, maybe they've got reasons to be serious when they're meeting the president of the United States and stuff. But then that meeting seems to go quite, you know, on the surface goes very well. But Sylvanus is saying, look, we're really an independent country and we have to share our ambassador from the United States with Cameroon, which is miles away. So yeah, it's not even a neighboring country. And, you know, there's some talk about, you know, lack of resources and not enough money to open a separate embassy. And then Eisenhower chips in with like, well, you know, maybe the ambassador, we could have an ambassador, and instead of building them a house, they could sleep in a tent with, like everybody else does in your country. And it's just like, yeah.
Super
he just
awkward.
Doesn't, super awkward. And then they also offend Nkrumah, because Nkrumah has a meeting with Eisenhower, and he doesn't really want to talk about the issues. He just talks about his own military service in World War II. And then the next day, Nkrumah gives a speech at the UN where he's very critical of the policy towards the Congo and believes that African nations should take the lead in solving the problem in the Congo, but also makes a big thing about keeping the Cold War out of Africa. He thinks that the Cold War should be kept out of Africa. And Christian Herter, the Secretary of State, interprets this as Nkrumah having sort of basically gone communist, which is exacerbated by the fact that as Nkrumah steps down from the rostrum, Khrushchev makes a big deal of getting up and shaking him by the hand. And I mean, he hasn't given a speech which is communist at all, but they just sort of interpret any criticism of the West as dangerous. Mm. So the Eisenhower administration is very flat-footed when it comes to this question of the newly independent African countries. So the whole sort of story of US policy and African decolonization in the 15th General Assembly is one of being a bit tin-eared, not rising to the challenge, not really getting the moment, I don't think, and ceding the initiative ultimately.
The United States is, in the description in your book, seems to come across to me as being deeply uncomfortable with the revolutionary struggles which have led to the independence of formerly colonized powers in the Third World. Is that fair, or does the kind of anti-imperial tradition in American politics find any outlet in 1960?
Yeah, it's interesting, and it's also ironic actually, because many of these anti-colonial struggles and the leaders of them had taken great inspiration from the Atlantic Charter, signed by Roosevelt and ironically Winston Churchill. Was it 1941, I think, wasn't it? So you know, which had talked about the rights of made a big thing about the right to self-determination. I think the Eisenhower administration, it supports decolonization because it believes that empires, sort of formal empires, has had its day, but it doesn't. But it also wants it to proceed in a very sort of orderly and careful way, and it also wants those newly independent countries to be anti-communist, and so it finds it difficult to navigate that. And I think that particularly for the Eisenhower administration, when it has to make a choice between offending a key European power, one of its key European allies like Britain, or supporting an anti-colonial movement in Africa, it always leans towards, or pretty much always leans towards, supporting the Western powers. The exception there is sort of Suez, which is a bit, but that's a bit more complicated, I think. But yeah, it is uncomfortable with the prospect that these new countries are going to be radical, or that they're going to pose some sort of threat to America's own interests. Fidel gives this very long, extremely long speech at the UN General Assembly. It lasts for 4.5 hours, which is still a record. Thankfully, still a record. It hasn't been broken yet. But one of the most interesting and most, I think, insightful things he says in that speech is that, you know, it's really easy to raise a flag, to come up with a new coat of arms, to sing a national anthem, and to declare independence. But unless you have economic sovereignty, unless you have the ability to craft your own economic policies, you don't really have true independence. And the United States is very resistant to any attempt by these newly independent countries to exercise real economic independence and to do things which seem to go against America's own interests. In terms of whether there's a sort of an outlet for the anti-imperialist sentiment, it seems to come in what is the emerging new left in the United States, both the academic new left, which is people like William Appleman Williams writing about a longer tradition of American empire or American expansionism or American imperialism.
In a critical way.
In a critical way, yeah, which is filtering down to a sort of new generation of college students and student activists. They're sympathetic to and they're inspired by that view of looking at America's history, and at the same time inspired by revolutionaries like the revolution in Cuba or in Algeria or elsewhere. So that's where that sentiment comes.
The Cuban revolution, the economic independence that Castro was seeking was very much economic independence at the expense of American business interests. So the pre-revolutionary Cuba under the Batista regime, at least this is the image I have, was Havana was a playground for rich Americans and American business interests dominated in the pre-revolutionary Cuban economy, right? So it in a way, whatever may or may not have been the impulse behind the different independence movements across Africa and Asia, in the case of Cuba, although that wasn't a straightforward anti-colonial struggle, because Cuba wasn't part of a formal empire before the Cuban Revolution, in an informal sense, it had been part of an American economic empire. So it was the closest that you came, perhaps, in the post-war era to an anti-American colonial struggle.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the way that Fidel and his fellow revolutionaries would have it. Cuba was run as a sort of economic colony of the United States. It was run for the benefit of American business interests, not for the benefit of the Cuban people. It was a playground for the rich and for the mob as well, for the mafia. And you know, Fidel had grown up in an area of Cuba which was dominated by the big American sugar companies. And although his own background was quite privileged, his father was quite wealthy and owned a sugar cane farm, and they lived in quite a grand house. You know, the kids that Castro went to school with, you know, were the sons and the daughters of sugarcane workers who earned a pittance. And at the same time, you know, American employees of these companies lived in these very fancy gated communities with sort of lavish facilities and a life of sort of luxury, really. So Castro is always keen to sort of make mischief. So when he expropriates American property and nationalizes American companies, he offers compensation in Cuban government bonds. But the value of those bonds, the value of the property is determined by the amount that the property was declared for tax purposes. And because the whole system was notoriously corrupt, it was all under-declared. So they're not getting their full worth back. But, you know, that's part of the point, really. He's making a point there as well about the fact that Cuba had been run, yeah, as a de facto economic colony of the United States. I think it was, you know, something like $1 billion worth of investments in Cuba. So there was a lot for Americans to lose. And so really any new Cuban government that really wanted to do something about that was going to run into difficulties, because it was going to antagonize business interests, was going to cause tensions with the United States.
Finally, Simon, I mean, what were the consequences of all this? I mean, it's a great story that you tell in your book, 10 Days in Harlem. I mean, it's a really rich and colorful story, and it brings together all these strands of geopolitics and racial politics in the United States and everything else, and all these world leaders together. After Castro left, what then? What's the long-term consequence of this episode?
There are a few things. One is his trip to New York sort of seals in the minds of the Eisenhower administration that there is absolutely no way that they can tolerate him. So they're, you know, they've already begun to think about a way to replace the regime in Havana. And in the weeks after Fidel flies back, they work up those plans more. They make them more sort of robust and more ambitious. And that's the origins of what becomes the Bay of Pigs invasion in the spring of 1961 under Eisenhower's successor, John Kennedy. I think that the meetings with Khrushchev are really important because they get on really well. And it signals that this is going to be a really important new strategic alliance, which is important in itself in terms of how the Cold War is going to play out over the next few years. But also, I think symbolically, is showing how the focus of the Cold War is shifting away from Europe and towards the countries of the global South, to Latin America, to Africa, to Asia. I think it's also, when Fidel arrives back in Havana, a lot of commentators, particularly both the British ambassador and the American ambassador there, sort of see in him a sort of a renewed zeal to make the Cuban Revolution not just a success for Cuba, but a sort of a genuinely world historic event. And I think Fidel's reputation as a global revolutionary is definitely improved, strengthened hugely by this trip, and helps to instill in him a real determination to put Cuba at the heart of the global anti-imperialist movement over the coming decade. And it also makes him even more of a folk hero to this sort of emerging new left and student counterculture. Mm. There's this great reception they have at the ballroom of the Theresa for him on the 22nd of September. And, you know, anyone who's, you know, a kind of a cultural bigwig, a literary bigwig, actors, all these people are there sort of fawning over him, desperate to have their photograph taken with him, asking for his autograph. It's a really early sign of what later comes to be known as sort of radical chic. And within the student movement in the 1960s, within the New Left, this sort of fating of revolutionary figures from Latin America, from Africa, from Asia, becomes a really defining characteristic of that movement. And I think that Fidel's trip to New York, and specifically his stay in Harlem, is an important part of sort of crafting that left-wing politics that is so central to the story of the rest of the decade.
Is there any way the Americans could have played it differently and more effectively?
Yeah, I love these counterfactuals. They're really fun to think about. I mean, it's hard to see how the situation could have really been recovered by September of 1960. But there's a great contrast in the way that Eisenhower behaves and the way that Harold Macmillan, the British Prime Minister, behaves. So Eisenhower is determined not to be seen anywhere near Fidel Castro, you know, in the General Assembly Hall or anywhere else. He's not going to meet him. He just derides him in private as a madman, sort of a dangerous figure. Macmillan, when he arrives in New York, one of the first things he does when he arrives in the General Assembly Hall is to stride across to NASA and to sort of shake him warmly by the hand and engage in some nice small talk and sort of turn on the charm. And of course, NASA is someone who has, you know, just 4 years before humiliated Britain over the Suez Crisis. And Macmillan, who was Chancellor of the Exchequer in Eden's government, was one of the leading hawks at that time, calling for Britain to intervene to take back the Suez Canal and to overthrow NASA, as he was seen as a sort of a Mussolini-type figure by Sir Anthony Eden. And yet, you know, Macmillan has the flexibility, the imagination, the willingness to put all that to one side and turn on the charm. And you sort of think, you know, it probably was never going to happen. But if Eisenhower or Christian Herter, for that matter, had gone over to Castro,
being the Secretary of State,
yeah, if one of them had gone had done that, you know, what would have happened? What might that have done? Would it have made any difference? When I read about that Macmillan's sort of gesture, it did make me think, you know, it'd be great to sort of rewind history a bit and just play that scene, but have Eisenhower, you know, make some sort of symbolic gesture and try to disrupt the situation in a different way, maybe.
He does. I will say, I mean, Macmillan comes across very well in your book, Simon. Eisenhower comes across really quite badly as a kind of rather grumpy, out of touch, not really getting what's going on. It's not a great portrait of presidential leadership.
No, it's not his finest hour. He's grumpy. I don't think he's in the best of health. He's irritable. There's an extraordinary recollection that his secretary, Anne Whitman, has. She overhears Eisenhower comments to her after, I think it's after Khrushchev's speech at the first speech at the General Assembly, which is very belligerent. And he says something along the lines of, you know, I wish there was nothing holding me back from pressing the button and sending all our nuclear missiles over to the Soviet Union, which is a sort of extraordinary thing to say, really. But yeah, he comes across as kind of, he's run out of steam, I think.
Yeah.
Let's be kind.
That's the plan.
He's run out of steam.
Simon, thank you so much. It's a great book and it's a great story. And as I think this conversation has shown, it's one of those great little stories that opens up in so many different directions. Simon, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you. It's been great.
Simon Hall's book is called 10 Days in Harlem. In the end, as Simon explained, Castro's visit was so provoking to Eisenhower precisely because he knew which buttons to press, which places to go, which people to see, to puncture the image of America the administration wanted to project. In the context of Cold War politics, American leaders wanted more than ever to be the last best hope of Earth. And as ever, that desire made the supposed redeemer nation especially vulnerable to the exposure of its contradictions, hypocrisies, and mundanely familiar, unexceptional social problems. You've been listening to the Last Best Hope podcast from Oxford's Rothermere American Institute. I'm Adam Smith, and if you've enjoyed this, please like us on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, and make it easy for others to find us. Goodbye.